So basically, as Mel Brooks's kid, I'm going to snort some coke off a model while driving my convertible on PCH while pissing on everything that you hold near and dear. And that's exactly what they thought initially. The initial reviews were horrible.
How to Be Amazing, brought to you by PRX. I'm Michael Ian Black. Among other things, my guest today is our nation's, and perhaps the world's, preeminent writer and lecturer on the subject of zombies. Max Brooks is the author of several books about zombies: The Zombie Survival Guide, World War Z, the comic book series The Extinction Parade, which shifts the focus from zombies to actually vampires fighting to save their own species in a zombie apocalypse. He's also the author of the graphic novel The Harlem Hellfighters, the true story of an African-American infantry unit. They were infantry, right?
They were National Guard infantry,
okay.
Yes.
Unit in World War I. And he is also the son of Mel Brooks and the late Anne Bancroft. Max Brooks, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right. I want to start with things that annoy me, or that at least I have questions about regarding zombies.
You got it.
Explain to me why brains are a zombie's food source.
They are so not.
Is it just flesh?
No, yes. The whole brain thing came from one movie called Return of the Living Dead, mm-hmm. which I despise because that movie...
It's not canon to zombies.
No, and it also was campy and hokey, and it did for the zombie genre what Adam West did for Batman.
Uh-huh.
It made it something to sort of laugh at and be cute, and it took the zombie genre something like 20, 30 years to dig out from under it and become scary again.
The dead have risen from the grave.
How many did you say?
100.
And now the question is, how do we get them back into the ground?
My next question is, they seem to be able to be penned up in places for months, if not years, and then emerge ready to devour again. How do they maintain their energy source when they don't have sustenance?
What I think about zombies and not being able to be locked in a room and then sort of come out swinging is that they simply don't have a metabolism anything like ours. They're a completely different organism. I like to compare it to sulfur-based life forms.
Okay, see, that annoys the hell out of me.
Yeah.
That annoys the hell out of me. What do you mean? They are in human form. They have to use our biology.
Not if they completely rewrite our DNA. As viruses do. That's the point of a virus. A virus is essentially a carjacker, and it comes into our DNA and completely rewrites the code. So we could actually have a virus that could turn us into sulfur-based life forms, or that can turn us into water breathers, or a virus that could pretty much do whatever it wants.
So you contend that in turning us into zombies, the zombies rewrite our DNA in such a way that we don't have a metabolism. So why do they eat at all?
Because that's a psychological, biological imperative. It has nothing to do with eating to ingest nutrition. It has to do with the bite. And the bite is to transfer the virus. So I would contend that they don't need to eat. No, I would contend that
what is their energy source?
That's an excellent question. I have no idea. And quite frankly, I don't care. I don't care about the zombies. I care about our reaction to zombies.
Okay, that's...
That's why I write about
interesting.
It.
Interesting.
That's all my work. My work is all about the reaction. I don't care why a hurricane happens.
Okay, but wait
but
a
I
minute.
Care but about how we react to it.
In order to stop the damn zombie hordes, we have to understand their energy source, don't we? If we can cut off the energy source, we can cut off the zombies.
We could, but what if... I'm more concerned with how we react to
all right.
a zombie.
All right. I mean, I guess we've come to an impasse on zombies.
I mean, my attitude is, personally, I don't care where AIDS came from.
Uh-huh.
What I care about is, why didn't the President of the United States in 1980 make a national announcement and educate us? And had we done that, we wouldn't have needed to find out the source of AIDS or even a cure for AIDS. We could have stopped AIDS with a pamphlet.
And you've said that your initial writing about zombies was a reflection of that, was a reflection
yeah.
of the AIDS crisis more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much... Everything I write about is our reaction to disasters and how we as a society drop the ball. I mean, AIDS could have been cured with a pamphlet. AIDS literally could have been a footnote in a medical journal if we had had one of these great 1940s, 50s, 60s national education programs. But we didn't, because it was the 1980s, in which the attitude of the Reagan era was, screw them.
I'm digesting that. I'm not sure I agree with you. I mean, yes, I agree with you about Reagan's reaction. I'm not sure I agree with you that it could have been stopped with a pamphlet.
Because it's just, you know how hard it is to get AIDS? It's so hard. It's not in the water. It's not airborne. It's not foodborne. I mean, it has to be direct fluid-to-fluid contact. That is the easiest virus in the world to stop.
And yet, but we know that now, and we haven't stopped it.
Well, no, now because we're stupid. Because, well, nowadays, nowadays you have young people running around saying, oh, well, I'm young and I'm invincible, and I'll just take a pill cocktail and I'll be okay. There's a well, I should back up by saying that whenever there's a plague, there's always a psychological arc that we as society go through. And that's just human nature. That goes back to the Black Death. You have great denial, which is, I can't get it. I'm pure. I'm Christian in the Black Death. Or in our case, I'm not gay or Haitian or an IV drug user, so I can't get it. And then you shift from great denial to great panic, which is, oh my God, it's everywhere. Anybody can get it. And that was the time in the 80s when doctors wouldn't treat patients or paramedics wouldn't treat car crash victims, where they thought AIDS was everywhere. And literally all we had to do was educate people and we could have stamped it out.
Were you, as a child growing up, you and I are roughly the same age, I think. And so I vividly recall the AIDS crisis as it blossomed. Were you aware at that time both of, well, I guess I'll just ask you simply, how did that affect you? Were you affected as a child, or is it only in retrospect you were thinking about it?
I was very aware of it because I grew up with a mom who was an actress but was a closet scientist. Mm-hmm. So I sort of grew up with her reading to me books like The Microbe Hunters about how diseases spread and about Pasteur and sort of how hard it was to stop so many of these diseases. So I already understood how that sort of happened. And then suddenly here's this disease where initially I didn't understand it. I was terrified. And then when we had sort of AIDS week at our school, I sort of took a step back and realized, like, well, wait a minute. This is really hard to get. Why the hell are so many people dying? And I firmly believe that there was an element in power in the 1980s that believed, oh, good, this is God cleaning house.
When you were now, did you grow up in California? You grew up in Santa Monica?
I grew up in Santa Monica, pretty much.
So clearly your parents were in entertainment. You must have known a lot of actors, actresses. Was your community, were your parents' community affected by AIDS?
Oh, yeah. I mean, AIDS just, it ripped through. Well, also, I used to spend my summers, because I'm from New York. I was born in New York. My family's still in New York. We used to spend our summers on Fire Island.
Right.
Now, we were not obviously in the gay community in Cherry Grove, but my mom and her sisters used to go shopping there. They loved it. And they talked about Cherry Grove like the Black Death had come through. I mean, just shops boarded up, houses for sale. I mean, it just ripped through it. And you saw people in my parents' circles who died. I mean, the vice principal of my school died. One day he vanished, and then he sort of came back about a year later, and I looked at him. He looked like a freaking zombie.
You've talked a lot in other interviews about, or maybe people have said this about you, actually, it's probably more apt, that you are a kind of a fearful, neurotic person.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate.
Do you trace that to that time in your life, or do you feel like you would have been that way anyway?
I think it's nature versus nurture. I think I probably had a genetic proclivity to neurosis. But I think had I been, say, adopted by a good Presbyterian Minnesota family working on the farm who just would say, walk it off and get over it, I probably would not have been as neurotic as I am now. I think growing up with two neurotic parents and also sort of growing up at that time in California, I mean, I don't know if you remember, that was the time when America lost its mind in the late 70s, early 80s, because it was the time when the kidnappings were happening, you know, kids were vanishing. Remember when Adam... That show?
Oh, yeah. The John Walsh's kid.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Then there was the drug crisis. Right. And then there was and my parents were not 60s parents. So to them, they were World War II parents. So mm-hmm. to them, drugs was very foreign. So my dad thought, you know, if you smoked a little ganj, then suddenly you were going to be shooting heroin into your nutsack.
Right.
So
you would be a crack zombie as opposed to an AIDS zombie.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. there was that. Then there was crime. I remember when the gangbangers started to get money and started to drive all around LA. And then we had that shooting in Westwood, which just shut down. Westwood was the part of LA where all the kids went. I mean, they shut down the cars. They roadblocked it. I mean, it was like New Orleans.
What was the shooting?
Well, two gangbangers took shots at each other and one bullet accidentally hit a UCLA student. And Westwood to this day has become a ghost town.
I mean, I feel like people are shooting each other the streets and colleges every single day now.
Oh, right. But it was the first.
Right.
Whenever something is the first, mm-hmm. then it's a big deal. So, and then we sort of wrapped up my childhood with the Rodney King riots.
Right. So you just grew up in a state of terror.
Yeah. Well, and in addition to that, growing up in LA, you have earthquakes.
Right.
You have fires.
And were you also worried, as I was, about the Soviets firing nuclear missiles
at
us?
Remember the day after?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, how much fun was that?
You guys hear anything about an alert?
I really don't think either side wants to be the first to use a nuclear device.
It's not a question of who, but where.
East Germany sealed off the borders to West Berlin.
It's not gonna happen.
People are crazy, but not that crazy.
It was my favorite thing, which was, if you don't know, the day after was a made-for-television movie about what would happen literally the day after the nuclear war.
Yeah, and it was literally my school sent pamphlets home with all of us to the... to the parents saying, do not let your kid watch this. And I remember watching the Super Friends or whatever. And my mother ran in shrieking, what are you watching? And I'm like, Mom, I'm watching the Super Friends. She's like, okay. All right. Thank God.
As long as it's not the nuclear
apocalypse. Yeah. She's literally like, don't watch Channel 2 right now.
Right. So were your parents, the image of Mel Brooks is clearly, you know, his sort of persona is sort of anxious and energetic and frenetic.
Yeah, that's pretty much him. What you see is what you get.
I've got to give in. I anxiety.
And remember, folks, be good to your parents. They've been good to you.
And your mom, you're saying, was similar?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there was a lot of neurosis.
And did they talk to each other about their fears, or they just sort of amplified each other's fears?
Oh, yeah. They talked to each other about it, and they talked to me about it. And it literally just was everywhere.
And so I guess, yeah, you grow up and want to write about your reaction to fear. I think that makes sense.
I think I am a child of a specific generation where the system broke down.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what do you mean by that?
Well,
I go, mm-hmm, like I know what you're talking about, and I don't.
Well, the 1970s was a time, for the first time in America, where there was a feeling like everything that we had grown up with and everything that we knew as normal was breaking down. Social, economic, environmental. I mean, the 1970s was the golden age for apocalyptic fiction, not just zombies. It's when zombie movies became popular, but remember, it was also Soylent Green mm-hmm. and all these other great apocalyptic movies, because there was this sort of feeling that we're headed for the apocalypse. And we sort of got over it in the 80s and really got over it in the 90s.
And yet you started writing Zombie Survival Guide in 97?
Yeah, I started writing it in response to Y2K fears. Because what was interesting to me at the time was we were living in the largest post-war boom in American history, and times were so great, and yet there still was this anxiety of the clock strikes 12, and the missiles are going to launch, and they'll land on the banks. And
it was terrible when that happened. It was so terrible when that happened.
And so I sort of always, you know, like we said, I've always grown up on the edge of the apocalypse in L.A. I mean, people say, do I have a zombie kit? Yeah, I've had an earthquake kit. It's the same stuff.
Right.
So that's when I started writing Zombie Survival Guide.
And why did you not try to publish it right away?
I didn't believe in it. I didn't think anybody in the known universe was as into this as I was.
Uh-huh.
Because I always grew up feeling like an outsider and a weirdo and never fitting in. So I thought there's clearly nobody into this except me.
So when you're writing that, what are you thinking?
I'm writing it for me.
Right.
I'm literally writing it because I went looking for this book. You know, I went out looking for how to fight zombies because I thought that'd be a really cool book to read. And of course nobody wrote it because nobody's as much of a weirdo and a loser as me. So I thought, well, I'll write it for me. I mean, I always write for me.
While you were writing that, you went to work on SNL.
Yes.
How did that come about?
What happened was those were the struggle years. And I was writing script after script and nobody wanted me and I couldn't get a job. I mean, I was doing cartoon voices, which was awesome, but it wasn't where I wanted to be. And I think when you're young, you don't know where you're making your mistakes. I think that's the worst part about being sort of young and dumb is not even knowing what you're doing wrong.
Or being 44 in my case.
Well,
still not having really much of an idea.
Yeah, no kidding. Then you get married and have a kid and you really realize how much you don't know. So we had a family friend, George Shapiro, Seinfeld's manager, Andy Kaufman's manager, and also Carl Reiner's nephew.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked if I could meet with him and just ask him, just sort of tell him what I'm doing and ask him what's wrong. So we met and we're sort of making small talk and he sort of asked me where I live. And I said, I'm living in the Valley. And he's like, why are you living in the Valley? Why don't you live on the West Side? And I said, I can't afford the West Side. He's like, what do you mean you can't afford the West Side? Your dad's Mel Brooks. I said, yeah, he can afford the West Side. I said, I'm not taking money from my parents.
Did you never take any money?
Obviously for school I did. Mm-hmm. But no, in the beginning, no.
Was it offered?
Oh, are you kidding? Of course.
Well, I don't know. I
mean, oh, God, yeah. No. My dad's like, hey, whatever you need, just take it. I was like, no, I need to try to see what I'm made of.
Right.
And that seemed to impress George. Mm-hmm. And he said, do you write comedy? I said, well, sort of. I guess so. I have a sketch packet for this new, I think Martin Short had a comedy pilot, and I submitted a sketch packet to
I don't remember.
A long time ago. And George said, well, I'll read your stuff. And he read it, and he said, it's good enough for me to pass along to Lorne Michaels. And I was like, yeah, you do that.
Right.
And Lorne Michaels called me and said, I'd like you to come out to New York. And I did. And I met with him. And he said, do you want to come work for us? And I said, oh, of course I do.
What year was that? Like 98-ish? 99-ish?
No, that was 2000. We were the class of 2001. We were the class of 9/11. Because I got the job. And then 2 weeks later, 9/11 happened.
And when 9/11 happened, you were living in New York. Did you at all feel vindicated? Were you at all like, see, this is what I've been told. I've been worrying about my entire life, and now here it is.
No, that one, when the first plane hit, I thought, oh, well, it's the accident like in World War II mm-hmm. when the plane hit the Empire State Building.
Right.
And then when the second one happened, I thought, oh, my God.
Right.
I didn't feel vindicated, but what was interesting was when the anthrax hit our building, it was a few months later, I think, mm-hmm. somebody mailed the white powder. And so they shut down 30 Rock and people were flipping out. I was actually not freaking out because I knew about anthrax. And I was looking at these people saying, guys, that level of panic.
But wait, why did you know about anthrax?
Because that level of panic and anxiety that suddenly everyone was living in, I was there. I was already there.
That was your comfort zone.
Welcome to my world, America. I've been here since I was 4 years old.
When crisis hit, both the 9/11 and the anthrax thing, did you feel calm? Did you feel prepared? How are you in a crisis?
I think I'm actually very good in a crisis. I ain't so good before one. Mm-hmm. I think it's the anticipation of when something is happening. Once something has happened, then I'm fine. Then I can actually react. It's the not knowing when something's going to happen. It's the difference between fear and anxiety. You know, fear is a tarantula pops out of a hole and you go, oh my God, it's a tarantula. Anxiety is, I wonder if there's a tarantula somewhere in a hole. That's when I don't do well.
And then you got fired from SNL.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Why?
Because I didn't fit in. And I knew that. I knew them going in when I got the job. George Shapiro said, don't thank me. It's the toughest job in show business.
Right.
And then I met someone who had been there and said, listen, let me tell you, the key to surviving SNL is fitting in. And I thought, well, I ain't going to survive. Because I'm just different. I've never been a team player. I've never been good at sort of group dynamics. I'm not a writer's room writer.
Did you feel like that was kind of your first professional setback?
I don't think so, because I didn't expect it and I wasn't banking on it. I never thought of myself as a comedy writer. So I didn't sort of see SNL as like, this is my step to becoming a great comedy writer.
And so what was the next step? You had this book sitting in a drawer.
No, actually, Zombie Survival Guide was going to be published already.
Oh.
In the summer in between my first and second season at SNL, I had met a book agent, Ed Victor, and he had read the manuscript and he had really liked it, but he didn't get it. He thought it was a comedy book.
Well, yeah, as anybody would.
Right. And Random House didn't get it. They thought it was a comedy book.
I remember seeing it in the bookstores and thinking, it's a comedy book.
And I fought against that, tooth and nail. I said, you can't do that. I said, if you put it in the comedy section, oh, I said, look.
When your ideal world, where did it belong?
Self-help. I thought, first of all, you guys need to understand the nerd culture. And we're talking about a nerd culture that doesn't exist anymore. You know, now nerds are...
Because at that time, before nerds was sort of co-opted.
Now nerds are mainstream.
Right.
Now nerds have hot girlfriends.
Yes.
That was not the case when I started.
No. And a scant 15 years ago,
nerds were
nerds.
Exactly. I said, look, guys, you need to understand, like, nerds, of which I am one of them, we are a very insecure lot. And the nerd world doesn't know me. I haven't sort of made my introduction to that world. So they're going to have preconceived notions, and they're going to think Mel Brooks's brat is taking a giant dump on something that they love.
Right. By putting it in the comedy section, you're saying this is a parody of the things that we care about.
Right. Right. So basically, as Mel Brooks's kid, I'm going to snort some coke off a model while driving my convertible on PCH while pissing on everything that you hold near and dear. And that's exactly what they thought initially. The initial reviews were horrible.
Really?
Oh, they were terrible.
But why? What was the knock?
Because
it's so straight. I mean, it's such a straight book.
And that's why. There were two venues that I was getting hit from. The first was like the LA Times, like the traditional media, which looked at it and said, like, this is supposed to be a comedy book.
Mm.
It's not funny.
Right.
And the nerd world thought that I was making fun of them. And so my wife said, you've got to go out and introduce yourself to your people. So I went to places like Fangoria, started doing interviews, talked about the horror films that had influenced me and sort of what a big nerd I was. And I started doing zombie lectures.
Which consist of what?
They consisted of literally doing a self-defense lecture.
Right. Preparedness.
I went to Greater Talent Network and I pitched myself and I said, I would like to take this book and I would like to talk about this book. And if you didn't know zombies were fake and you walked in, you'd know how to be ready. And I always like to tell the story that the one like hot agent, this one girl was like, that's kind of geeky. And I said, I beg your pardon, miss. It is not kind of geeky. It is the geekiest thing ever done. And so therefore, the one geek agent in the back, Mike D'Andrea, was like, hey, I'll take a shot on this. So God bless him. He hustled for me and got me on the road. And I started doing these zombie lectures. And that changed everything.
Welcome back to How to Be Amazing. When you grow up feeling like an outsider and a weirdo, coupled with two very neurotic parents who reinforce your fear of the world, you could hide under a desk for the rest of your life, or you could do what Max Brooks did and write a best-selling disaster survival guide. That the disaster takes the form of a zombie apocalypse is a little bizarre, but nevertheless, the Zombie Survival Guide is the perfect book for anyone worried about a nuclear disaster, earthquake, or, yes, protection from the living dead. Coming up, Max gives me some helpful survival tips, including whether or not to resort to cannibalism, and we talk about his terrific new graphic novel, The Harlem Hellfighters, which is a window into a little-discussed chapter of World War I history about the all-black 369th Infantry Regiment. Your dad is a World War II veteran, and you're probably one of the few people my age whose actual parents
right.
were in the war. Did he talk about those experiences growing up? And do you think that history, that sort of immediate history that your father experienced also informed this love?
Yeah. Being a Gen Xer, all my friends' parents were baby boomers. Mm-hmm. So their stories were about getting high and going to concerts and divorces they've had and, you know, as George Carlin said, from cocaine to Rogaine. Mm-hmm. That wasn't my dad or my mom. You know, my dad talked about being in combat and his brothers talked about being in combat. So I would sit around and hear about my uncle getting shot down and being a POW, or my other uncle having every tropical disease imaginable, or my other uncle being in the shower on his ship when a torpedo hit and having to scramble out before the ship went down. So that was my childhood. My dad telling
me— In addition to all the other catastrophes.
Right. Right. And when people say, like, did your father help you write Zombie Survival Guide? Yes, he did, because he taught me things like how to survive frostbite.
Mm-hmm.
And how to shoot a .30-06. So yeah, he was very helpful in that way.
I couldn't help but think about, both in terms of the zombie world, Harlem, Hellfighters, and thinking about your dad's experiences in war, and then coupling that with being Jewish, the idea of zombies and sort of perpetual threat spoke to my Judaism in a way.
Yeah.
And
I think that's pretty much on the nose there. Jews, we are a tribe always hunted. Always. And that's just the way it is. And it doesn't matter what we do, there's always somebody gunning for us. And if we try to defend ourselves, then the world comes down on us for defending ourselves too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being Jewish, you grow up hearing about the Holocaust. And for everybody else, the Holocaust is some sort of tragedy in the back of their minds. But for us, like, that was our families.
So you start doing these lectures, and what do they consist of? Is it literally just, this is how you survive when the world has gone to shit?
Yeah, I mean, it literally was a zombie apocalypse lecture. I did my first one, I think it was like 2003, 2004, flop sweating like Albert Brooks in broadcast news, because mm-hmm. no one had ever done that. And I thought, well, if I'm bombing, what am I going to do? It's not like doing stand-up where if you're bombing, you can suddenly start ripping off, you know, George Carlin. I can't rip off other people's zombies lecture. So I get on stage and I'm—
And where are you?
I'm in, I think it's Colorado College. And I'm talking, and there's like 200 people there, and I'm sweating, and I'm nervous, and I sort of get through it, and I said, now I'd like to open the floor up to questions. And I thought, okay, now is the time that they've suffered through my BS. Now they're going to ask me what they really want to know, which is about my dad or being on SNL. And sure enough, it was all zombie questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'm not the only person in the world who's into this.
Why? I'm sorry to keep asking the zombie questions, but why is it only byte transferable? Like, if I have an open sore.
Oh, no, you can. It's fluid to fluid. I mean,
okay.
Like, if you're walking around and you have a huge open sore and
right.
I blow a zombie apart with a shotgun next to you and
right.
some of that gore flies over.
Right.
Yeah, you'll get infected.
See, that's a problem that I have with The Walking Dead, because sometimes they'll shoot a zombie. The zombie blood will get on their face or something, but they don't turn into zombies.
That's called television.
It drives me crazy.
I mean, look, that's television where we have to
right.
sort of.
But in the real world, obviously, when you shoot a zombie and you get blood on your face or
yeah.
in your eye, you turn into a zombie.
Well, of course, look, in the real world, these sort of alpha male heroes that we think would be the great surviving warlords of the zombie apocalypse, in the real world, most of them within 6 to 8 months would be on their knees giving hand jobs for raw potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Because the truth is, in an apocalyptic world, there really are no heroes. And all you have to do is study the fall of Rome to understand that, or China in the 1930s, or sort of any apocalyptic world. I mean, look at Somalia now. Look at some of these failed states. These alpha males, these heroes that we think would happen, these Mad Maxes, they have a life expectancy of about 6 to 8 years, and that's it.
So who survives? The hiders?
Yeah.
Good, because that's who I would be.
Yeah, no, no. The tigers would be dead, the cockroaches and the rats would live.
It seems like zombies, at least in your worldview of them, are political, or at least our reaction is political. And I wonder how much of your politics informed your writing or vice versa.
Well, I tried to stick to the facts, and I just tried to base everything on how humans have survived other apocalyptic scenarios throughout history. Like, World War Z is all based in history. Everything that happened in the book has actually already happened, just without zombies.
Right.
So it's not so much what I would want to happen, it's how things have already happened.
And so, having studied how things happen, do you then have a preferred method of how you would like things to happen governmentally?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I think we need to have more civilization, not less. Mm-hmm. And I think...
And how do you define that?
Well,
do you define civilization as government?
Yeah. And a government by, of, and for the people is all of us. I mean, that's why when Reagan said government is the problem, that means we're the problem, because we're the government.
Did that attitude or ethos inform your decision to write the Harlem Hellfighters?
Yeah. I mean, I've been fascinated by the Harlem Hellfighters for years because of that sort of seminal moment in World War I. Because World War I is the first war that we fought as a nation to make the world safe for democracy.
Do you understand why World War I started in a capsule way that our audience will
yes,
understand?
Yes, I'll tell you exactly why. Across the Atlantic Ocean, there's a place called Europe.
Okay, hold on.
Step one.
I've heard of it, yes.
Right. Now, 2,000 years ago, there was an amazing civilization called Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a society based in laws and logic and citizenry.
And some slavery.
And slavery, yeah. But slavery, which you could buy your way out of.
Mm-hmm.
And civilization. And then these barbarians came. These lice-bitten, anally raping barbarians came and destroyed that civilization. And
who were those barbarians?
Well, they were different tribes who hated each other for no other reason than they were different tribes. And they believed in brutality and blood and stupidity and self-destruction. 2,000 years later, in 1914, those barbarians were still there. Now, they had built nicer buildings, and they had composed some nice songs, and they had conquered the rest of the world, but at their core, they were still these horrible, bloodthirsty barbarians.
Now, I feel like you're saying the Austrians and Germans are horrible.
No, I'd throw the
barbarians.
French and the British. I would throw them all in.
Right.
I would throw every European uh-huh. head in there.
Not the Swedes. Surely not the Swedes.
Oh, God, no. Well, if you're the Norwegians, then yeah.
Okay. Or if you're the Finns, I guess.
Yeah. So basically, these barbarians had spent 400 years raping and conquering the entire world, and they didn't know what else to do. So then they turned on each other. And they were just simply too stupid not to have a war.
Mm-hmm.
And this war happened for absolutely no reason. And once the war started, they were too stupid to know how to turn it off. And that's pretty much World War I.
I mean, that's as cogent an explanation as I think I've ever heard
yeah.
of World War I. And as I'm running through what I know about World War I, seems to basically fit the facts.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
So why did we get involved in World War I?
Well, and this is the really critical thing about America, because we're still on that road, still mm-hmm. to this day. There are reasons that our politicians and our corporations, our banks, whatever, there's reasons that they get involved in wars, including World War I. But the reason the American people got involved was what Woodrow Wilson said. Woodrow Wilson gave us a reason to go to war that politicians are still using to this exact day.
Which is what?
Which is, we fight to make the world a better place.
Hmm.
Americans don't fight for treasure. We don't fight for land. We don't do that stuff. We fight for ideals.
Right. Except that we totally fight for
treasure.
That's,
yeah. Well, that's why our corporations do.
Right.
But how do you get the average American to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, no American is ever going to put on a uniform and go to fight in Europe because American banks have loaned more to British banks than they have to German banks.
Right.
That ain't gonna happen. But if you tell Americans you're fighting to make the world a better place, we are a country of ideals, And it is our job to let the rest of the world live by those ideals. And in that is the tremendous hypocrisy, in that we therefore have to live up to those ideals at home. And that's what's so fascinating about World War I, is we go to war to make the world safe for democracy, when at the same time we don't have democracy for everyone at home. Women weren't allowed to vote. Native Americans weren't even considered citizens, and Black people were treated like Black people.
And out of that come the Harlem Hellfighters.
The Harlem Hellfighters.
This group of all African Americans, and as you say, designed to fail.
Exactly. Because the government knew the hypocrisy that it was sowing in this, and they realized, oh, crap, if these Black guys go over to Europe and make Europe safe for democracy, they are then going to come home and demand the same democracy here at home. So we better make damn sure they don't get into combat and don't come home as heroes. So they did everything possible to sabotage them. They gave them poor uniforms and poor training, didn't give them guns. They had to write to their own government pretending to be phony rifle clubs to get donated guns.
Wow.
Then they were sent to South Carolina hoping there'd be a race riot, because there had just been a race riot in Texas. There wasn't. These guys were disciplined enough not to fight back. They weren't allowed to march off to Europe with the rest of the New York units in what's called the Rainbow Division, because they were told Black is not a color of the rainbow. Then when they went over, they were not allowed to be in combat unless they were given to the French army and they fought with the French. And they did. And they came home as one of the most decorated units in the entire U.S. Army.
And when they came back, they were greeted with a hero's welcome.
Yeah.
The send-off they'd been denied, but the welcome was, they were paraded down Fifth Avenue.
A million New Yorkers turned out to, of all colors, turned out to welcome them home.
And your relationship with the military is not tangential. I mean, you joined the ROTC.
Yeah.
Was that in high school or college?
That was college.
And with an eye towards joining the military?
No, I was just young and dumb. It was Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and I thought I was going to do my part. I didn't realize that my part was exposing sciatica and probably scoliosis.
So I say you join the ROTC, you say, oh God.
Yeah.
Because you were bad at it, or because it wasn't what you expected?
Yeah,
because
crazily enough, some things I was really good at.
What were you good at?
I was really good at land navigation, shockingly enough. I mean, I could find my way with a map and a compass.
Right? This is pre-GPS.
Yeah. And that was the first time in my life that a teacher had ever called my work outstanding, ever. I was good at rappelling. I was good at air assault. I was good at digging in a fortified position. I was pretty good at cleaning my weapon. You know, what I was not good at was running, because I didn't know that my feet pointed in different directions, because I'd never played sports. Because I didn't care.
Wait, what do you mean they point in different? Don't everybody's feet point in different directions?
Well, my knees point together and my feet point apart.
Uh-huh.
And I have really crooked feet and really, and possibly a little scoliosis in my back. But none of these defects ever came to light because I never played sports. So suddenly here I am running a couple miles every day, and suddenly I get these shooting pains up my back.
Yep.
And then I go to the doctor and he's like, Jesus, what kind of orthotics do you use? And I'm like, what are orthotics?
And so how long did you wash out of the ROTC, or you sort of finished up and you're like, okay, I'm done?
No, I mean, I said to them, like, I have pronate feet. And they're like, oh, well, you know, I can't really use you. Now, the irony is Desert Storm ended like a day later or so. Right. It ended like a couple weeks later. Mm-hmm. And then after that, half of my unit ended up being inactive, ready, reserve, because that was the giant drawdown.
Mm.
But the cool part was one of the guys in my unit was one of the first guys to sue the Army over Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Oh, interesting.
And he was a genuine warrior. And that sort of changed my attitude on gays in the military.
Did you have a contrary attitude about it beforehand?
Well, I mean, we grew up in the most homophobic time that there was. I mean, we grew up in a time when Sam Kinison could say, thanks, fags, thanks for giving us the Black Plague of the 80s. And a whole stadium of people got up and cheered. And then I sort of look back at Cadet Stephen May, and I think, well, wait a minute, I'm a really crappy soldier. You don't want me out there. Trust me, you do not want me out there. But him? This guy keep us safe at night, and you're going to kick him out? Why?
It's interesting to me, though, as somebody who was so aware of the AIDS crisis, and yet what your attitudes towards, was it just gay soldiers specifically, or was it a kind of generalized fear of homosexuality?
Yeah, I think it was just general good old-fashioned 1980s homophobia, especially when you're a teenager. And I think that's just the way it was. I mean, and what's funny about it was my teacher once said to us all, you know, you guys say it's okay to hate gay people, but when I was your age, we said it was okay to hate black people. Mm. And we were like, oh no, it's totally different. Of course it wasn't, but we didn't know.
Well, we still hear that argument today.
Yeah.
That it's totally different.
Yeah. No, it's not different. It's hate. It's just hate is hate.
Your relationship with the military seems to only have grown, though, with the success of Zombie Survival Guide. And now you speak to the military about surviving the zombie apocalypse. How did that happen?
They invited me. I've been invited to speak at places like the Naval War College and at West Point. I was invited to speak at a hurricane rehearsal of concept drill for FEMA and for the Army. Because if you take the zombies out of Zombie Survival Guide and of World War Z, it's just disaster preparedness. And I think it's a great way to get the common citizen thinking about these systems that keep them alive.
What are three things that we don't think about that we need to think about?
I think we don't think about where does our water come from? When we turn on the sink. Yeah. When we turn on that sink, what guarantees that we're not going to get Giardia or cholera or any of these other diseases? Or how do we guarantee that when we turn on the sink, water's going to come out?
And pay the bill.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully. If you live in California, it doesn't matter. You may pay the bill. Water still may not come out.
Uh-huh.
I mean, civilization is really hard. And it takes a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of people working 24/7 to sort of keep us safe and alive. And I think we've forgotten that.
Okay, so wait.
So water.
Water.
Water's one thing.
And then what do? We just have water on hand, right?
Well, in a disaster, you need water on hand, right. Obviously. More importantly than water, you need a way to purify
right.
it. And not a Brita filter, you need a hand pump.
Mm-hmm.
In a disaster, you're also going to need, I mean, the truth is you really don't need that much food. Because you can go like a month without food.
Right.
And in that point, the system will come back. You really only need 72 hours emergency supplies. So you definitely need water. You need a medical kit.
Mm-hmm.
A radio is really important.
Solar? Hand crank?
Crank. Yeah, because that way you need to find out, like, are they saying stay put or you need to get out now?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think those are the most sort of important. And I think more important than anything, you need a plan. You need to know where your loved ones are.
You forgot the most important thing of all.
Which is?
Love. You need love.
Nah, you don't need
love. Love is probably going to hurt you.
Yeah.
Love is going to kill you.
Although the funny thing is people say to me that country folk would be better off than city folk.
Why?
I don't know. That's what they say to me. I'm like, really? I'm like, I don't agree with that at all. I think it depends on the city you're talking about.
Yeah. And the folk you're talking
yeah.
about.
I mean, I think like New York is in an amazing position to survive pretty much anything. Whereas LA, you're a goner.
New York, because it's isolated, you can shut
because
the bridges, the tunnels.
Because New York is an actual city. New York has some of the best run city systems in the world. Mm. And LA, where I live, has some of the worst.
Right.
I mean, LA, you are on your own in a disaster.
So are you prepared? Do you have
yeah.
the MREs and do you have guns?
Yeah. My wife will not let the guns be in the house.
I think that's wise. You have a kid.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm fine with that. Mm-hmm. I'm a gun-owning liberal.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm okay with any kind of gun regulations. I've never heard anyone say, thank God for that 30-round magazine.
Right.
You know, show me the person who's been saved by the 11th bullet. I think 10 rounds is fine.
So you have a daughter?
I have a son.
A son. How old?
He's 10 years old.
Okay, so are you conscious about fear in front of your son?
Yes, and I lie to him all the time. I lie to him constantly. I tell him, like, when he says things like, Dad, I scratched myself. Am I going to be all right? I'm like, yeah, you're going to be fine.
And in your head, you're thinking, no, you probably won't be all right. You're going to lose that arm?
No, I know he's going to be fine, but the other side of me that growing up is like, oh, my God. So, but I never panic around him. I'm always calm. I'm always like, I'm like, dude, everything's going to be just fine. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want him seeing the kind of panic that I grew up with.
And how was Grandpa around him?
Oh, my God. Grandpa, this is the sound of Grandpa.
And that is careful, careful.
It's careful, careful. Always nervous. Wait.
Do you see a lot of yourself in him? Do you see that same kind of neurosis, that same kind of proclivity towards
fear? Oh, yeah. No, I see it. He has a genetic proclivity towards neurosis.
And is your wife the same way?
Yeah. I mean, we saw that in each other and we're both trying to, but the difference is we're both hyper-conscious of it.
Right.
And fighting.
I can't imagine like baby-proofing your home with you and what a nightmare that was.
We were so nervous. Well, yeah, we were super, super nervous. And but with him, we have the facade that we are calm Gentiles and that everything is just fine.
I like that it's Gentiles. We're Gentiles around our son.
Oh yeah.
No, I get it.
Oh, Gentiles have this wonderful word, whatever. I don't understand that word. I don't know. It's probably some Norwegian Swedish thing, but it's just they're just like, oh, whatever.
Right.
What do you mean, whatever?
I think it means the absence of catastrophe.
I think
that's how it's translated into English.
Well, the funny thing is, I think that. That's going to get most people killed in a zombie apocalypse. When I was at one of the Comic-Con, there was a kid in a wheelchair, and he said to me, do you think I'd be the first to die? And I said, no, you'd be the last to die. And he's like, what do you mean? I said, well, look, I said, everybody else in this room thinks the world belongs to them. They think they're safe. They walk out of their door thinking, good morning, USA, and they're fine. I said, you probably leave your door every day ready to do battle with a hostile world. And he's like, yeah. I'm like, so you don't need to make that tremendous mental shift from safety to danger. You're already ready. And that's what's going to kill most people in most disasters is that mental shift to, oh, this is dangerous.
Don't you long for safety though?
Yeah, but it's doesn't exist.
But it does. I mean, you're fine.
Oh, no. I mean, it exists in moments.
No, but it's existed in all of your moments. You're fine.
I'm fine for the moment.
And all of your moments preceding this moment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but the thing is, like, you never know. So what I try to do is enjoy the moments.
But I don't feel like you do enjoy them. I feel like you're looking at the holes waiting for the tarantula to come out.
And it has.
No, it hasn't. You're here. You're
okay,
fine.
I'm literally, when I was in ROTC, we're at Camp Pendleton, training to go over, fight Saddam Hussein, marching in single file column, and what do you think popped out of a hole right in the middle of us?
And did it bite you? No, you're fine.
We scattered.
Of course you did. All right, so as we wrap up, I like to conclude each episode with something called the Amazing Five, in which I will ask, I mean, I'm just going to give you categories, and I would like a recommendation in each of these categories. You're an author. Why don't we start with books, a book that you would recommend?
Red Army by Ralph Peters.
What is it?
It is a book written in the 1980s about the Soviet invasion of Western Europe, told completely from the Soviet point of view.
Oh my God, I have to read that book. And I think that's the only time I've ever had that reaction to a guest's recommendation. I have to read that book.
For me,
that sounds fantastic.
It was transformative because it was humanizing an enemy that my country had sort of made out to be the Borg.
Right.
So it was a win, and it was written by a U.S. Army intel expert.
Oh, interesting.
Who had studied the Soviets. He knew them. He was studying them in order to defend us from them.
Is it an oral history like World War Z, or it's a more traditional narrative?
No, it's a traditional narrative.
A movie?
Oh, let's see. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Really? The Johnny Depp?
Yeah. Amazing movie.
I've never seen it.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, first of all, it's amazing because it's Terry Gilliam.
Right.
And, you know, he's amazing. But also, what I think it's wonderful is I think it's really important to study because the country is being run by baby boomers right now. Mm-hmm. And there was a seminal moment where baby boomers, when their dreams came crashing down and they gave up.
We had all the momentum. We were riding the crest of a high and beautiful wave. So now, less than 5 years later, you can go up on a steep hill in Las Vegas and look west. And with the right kind of eyes, you can almost see the high water mark. That place where the wave finally broke and rolled back.
And what's that moment?
It's sort of the late 60s, early 70s. And that is when Fear and Loathing takes place, where you sort of see the optimism of the 60s.
Collapse.
Exactly.
What's going on with the second World War Z?
That's a really good question.
You don't know.
I really
do they not
know.
Keep you in the loop at all?
No. And I'm totally fine with that.
Do you, will you get a nice check if it gets made?
I don't know if it get, I probably will. I'll probably get like a production bonus or something like that. But I mean, more importantly is more people will read the book. That's what I care about.
Right. Of course. So. I confess to not having read the book, and because I saw the movie and I thought, oh, well, the movie must be the book, and apparently it's not at all.
No, not at all.
So now I have to read it.
It is not a bad movie.
I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too. It was a really cool movie that happened to have the same title as a book I once wrote.
Right, right.
And I give props to Brad Pitt for sticking with it because there was a time when everybody thought it was going to be the new Waterworld.
Really?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean,
I don't remember that.
The media storm around it was everybody was waiting for him to fail. Everybody was hoping for him to fail. And
they reshot the whole third act or something, is
yeah,
that right?
And there was a huge thing about how it's over budget won't it be so nice when this pretty boy falls on his pretty face?
Right.
And
believe me, I have to deal with that every single day.
Me too. I go out in the street and everyone's like, hey, John Cryer, how's it going?
I think you look more like Peter Gallagher.
Really? Oh, yeah, maybe. I think it's the ducky thing has always sort of followed me.
I mean, now that you say it, yes. So listeners, picture a combination of Peter Gallagher and John Cryer. Food.
Oh. Well, there's nothing better than my Aunt Joan's Italian cooking.
That's gonna be tough for our listeners to get a hold
of. Good spaghetti and meatballs, I think. I'm partial to my marinara sauce that I make with ingredients I grow in my own garden.
Now, is this your garden or is this your mom's garden? Because I read about that
yes.
She had this huge garden that you only developed an interest in after she died.
Right. So I kept up her garden. My garden is much simpler. It's more of just a vegetable plot that I sort of grow fruits and vegetables. My mom's, I get all exotic. I grow things like sugarcane and tobacco and cotton.
Did you know you liked gardening?
I think as a little kid, I enjoyed it. I think when you put a little pea in the ground and it comes up, and I thought that was really cool. And every day you wake up and you want to see how much it's grown.
Right.
And then when I got older with the garden, it was the only physical thing that I did. And it's great to turn your brain off and actually work with your hands.
Mm-hmm. Also good skills to have.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case.
Oh, let me tell you.
Do you keep a seed library?
I do, actually. I bank my own seeds.
I'm sure you do.
And the key to survival is... making your own compost, finding fertilizer. I'm a good fertilizer scrounger. You know, when I go hiking in Will Rogers, I bring a garbage bag with me and I collect all the horse poop.
Oh, God, you're a nut.
Spread it all out there.
I feel like you can go to a garden center and just buy fertilizer.
Yeah, but it's literally sitting there. It's sitting there for free.
In the event of full apocalypse, do you resort to cannibalism or do you never get that far?
I think it depends on who you're talking about.
I'm talking about you.
Would I result to full cannibal? Like if I was starving?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
I think I do.
Yeah.
I've thought about this. I think I do. I don't even feel like I have that big a hangup about it. I'm like, he's dead. I'll eat him.
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, because the truth is, I've always been more concerned with dehydration than with starvation.
All right. So wait, I did movies. I did. I didn't do music.
You didn't do music. Oh, that's a good question. My wife teases me for terrible early 80s, late 80s musical taste. Well, I think sort of the theme song of Marriage and Children is Social Distortions, I Was Wrong.
Great, great song. Yeah, fantastic. A miscellaneous, anything from your life that you would recommend?
A thing?
It could be anything. Could be an activity. Could be a thing. It could be a thought.
Here's I think, the thought that I have come to understand. Also from writing Harlem Hellfighters. Is that every generation has an obligation to change its thinking and then not poison the generation after it. Because it's all very well and good for me when I write Harlem Hellfighters to talk about these horrible racists, but I was no different being a horrible homophobe as a teenager. So it was my job to do two things, to change my thinking and then to make sure that I never poisoned my son.
Great way to wrap up, not only because it's a profound thought, but also because it leads me to believe that you think there will be a future. Which I find reassuring coming from you.
Oh, God. No. I am a neurotic optimist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I'm not a pessimist. And I don't believe in that at all. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love the Smiths, but...
I suspect the listeners may have gotten a different impression, so I'm glad you're
I'm a huge optimist. Well, you have to be. This is America. America is a country based on dreams, and you have to wake up from your dreams and then make them come true.
Right.
So if you're a pessimist and you just believe that life is just shite and things are never going to work out, there's a wonderful place called Europe. Go there.
Well, Max Brooks, thank you so much for the work, for the uplifting words at the end, and thank you for being amazing.
Thank you very much.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, please write us a nice review on iTunes. Say how handsome I sound. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio, New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Jason Saldanha with music composed by Chad Crouch. Post-production work was also done by Barry O'Halloran. I am, as always, Michael E.